G'day and welcome to Between the Lines. I'm Tom Switzer. As always, it's wonderful to have your company. Well, today, the fragmentation of Australian conservative politics. Why the centre-right in this country keeps losing cultural debates to progressives. And later in the show, the legacy and life of one of America's most eminent and controversial presidential historians, Arthur Schlesinger, who in particular chronicled the Kennedy administration. His biographer, Richard Aldous, knew Schlesinger and has written what I think is a terrific book about him. But first, writing in the Australian newspaper recently, the distinguished political journalist and historian Paul Kelly argued, quote, "Conservatives these days excel at drumbeating, making a lot of noise, writing a lot of articles, and losing every substantial battle. They're fragmented, intellectually confused, and strategically inept." Paul Kelly went on to argue, "Conservatives lost the issue of same-sex marriage. They're likely to lose the issue of religious freedom. They're losing the battle over legalising euthanasia on almost every front, from climate change to coal to gender politics to Western civilization heritage. Conservatives are on the defensive." Well, Paul is in our Canberra studio. Hi there, Paul.
Hi, Tom. Good to talk with you.
And with me in Brisbane is James Allen. James is a professor of law at the University of Queensland and editor of Making Australia Right. Where to from here? G'day, Jim.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be here.
Paul, why is Australian conservatism in crisis in 2018?
I think there are a number of fundamental causes. First of all, conservatives in Australia have very little cultural power, much less than they do in the UK and the US. The entire cultural sector and arts industry is hostile to them. They've got very little support from the educational institutions or university sector. The ABC and the Fairfax Media is hostile. Conservatives, frankly, aren't strong in the business community. Beyond that, I think they're not organised. There's no coherent conservative movement in this country, and any movement to be successful needs leaders. Tony Abbott aside, I think that there's been a conspicuous lack of leadership when it comes to the conservative side of politics and ideas. They've been completely outmanoeuvred by the progressive side of politics, that broad alliance comprising Labor, the Greens, the trade unions, GetUp, the environmental lobbies, the law, welfare and health professional bodies. But I think there's probably a deeper reason, and that is conservatism as an ideology doesn't have deep roots in the Australian political tradition. Europeans settled on this continent after the American and French revolutions, and as the 19th century advanced, political liberalism was the real dominant force in this country. If we look at the non-Labor side of politics, it was remade four times during the 20th century. It was the Liberal Party, then it was the Nationalist Party, then the UAP, and then in 1944, under R.G. Menzies again, the Liberal Party. But we've never had a Tory party, we've never had a Conservative party, and I think conservatism alone as an ideology doesn't suffice in Australia. It hasn't in the past, and I don't believe it will in the future.
What about during the Howard years, though, Paul? Because the Conservatives certainly did not control the commanding heights of Australian culture, and yet John Howard won four elections on the trot, and the centre of political gravity during the Howard era did move decidedly to the right, didn't it?
I think that's true, and it's also important to note that John Howard framed the Liberal Party that he led as a broad church, and Howard presented himself as the champion of two political traditions, the conservative tradition and the liberal tradition. And in that sense, what Howard was attempting to do, I think, was to go to what he saw as the roots of the Liberal Party and articulate that for Howard's own time. But the point to make is that since Howard left politics, his successors, in particular Tony Abbott and Malcolm Turnbull, have not been able to maintain that broad coalition appealing to both conservatives and liberals.
I agreed with the first half of just about everything Paul said. Partly I'd like to say that the reason conservatives lose on the cultural front is they don't even fight. You've got Malcolm Turnbull appointing people to the ABC that beggars belief. You have Team Turnbull appointing people like Ed Santow to the Human Rights Commission that the Greens would probably appoint. You know, you just run through the appointments to the courts You can't actually win these fights unless you try to win, or at least you put up some sort of coherent argument. The universities are completely captured by the left, although that's true in Canada, my native Canada. It's true in the U.S. So I agree with Paul on that part. On the second part, if your criterion is we don't have a conservative party, well, New Zealand doesn't have a conservative party. The U.S. doesn't have a conservative party. Canada, for most of its time, had a progressive conservative party. It's only after Stephen Harper, who was an insurgent figure who came out of Alberta with the Reform Party and basically destroyed the Progressive Conservative Party because it wasn't right-wing enough. And he did a reverse takeover, and now they have a party named the Conservative Party. So I don't think you can determine this by the name of the party. The Liberal Party is, to a large extent, a right-of-center party. Some of the things that Paul mentioned, like same-sex marriage or euthanasia, I don't really care about those issues. I consider myself a conservative. I don't care about those issues at all. I'm a Hobbesian. I believe in borders. I'm a small government guy. I don't want to spend all sorts of money so that vice chancellors get paid $1.5 million a year. And those sort of things, the Turnbull government is doing nothing about it.
Paul, I mean, Jim's not alone here. I know of many conservatives. You think of Andrew Bolt, The Spectator Australia, The Quadrant Crowd. They will all too often warn that the Turnbull government is Labor light, and that's why it's drifting to defeat at the next election. Is that really the case, Paul?
No. They don't understand Australian politics, and their capacity to analyse it is severely defective. I'd make a couple of points about Turnbull. Turnbull doesn't see himself as a conservative, and he doesn't see himself as an ideological warrior. Now, that is certainly a problem for Turnbull when it comes to the conservative vote. And I understand conservatives getting very frustrated by that aspect of Turnbull. If we look at the content of Turnbull's policies, I think it's fairly clear that Turnbull tries to govern from the centre. For example, there are a number of strong right-wing, or if you like, conservative policies that Turnbull has embraced, from boats and border protection to a very strong line on national security, a very strong line against China when it comes to foreign interference, attempting to establish a very effective relationship with Donald Trump, rejecting the Aboriginal voice to Parliament, supporting a number of foreign investment restrictions when it comes to agricultural land, maintaining the Abbott position on industrial relations in relation to the ABCC. So there are a whole series of areas where Turnbull has been quite right-wing in the Abbott tradition. The really important point about Turnbull is that he's not a cultural warrior. So he doesn't attempt to run ideological campaigns in this area, and Turnbull does face a really severe problem bleeding conservative votes away to Corey Bernardi and Pauline Hanson.
Well, Jim, I mean, how would you respond to that? I mean, Turnbull is clearly not a cultural warrior, but as Paul points out, you know, he supports tough border protection, anti-terror laws, company income tax cuts, China, Trump.
Well, there's a few things Paul left out. He left out that certainly Mr. Turnbull was no fan of Trump before the election. In fact, almost embarrassed.
Yeah, but look at the substance of what Turnbull's doing since he's been
he's moved.
Since Trump's been in the Oval Office.
I mean, he's throwing billions at Gonski, and I don't know that you have to be a cultural conservative to dislike that. He's throwing money at the NDIS. You don't have to be a cultural conservative to dislike that. He's raised the bank tax while at the same time talking about wanting a corporate tax cut, as if banks aren't part of a corporation. He's made horrible appointments. We have the highest energy costs in the democratic world. When I got here in 2005, they were the lowest. Not all his fault, but personally, I would pull out of the Paris Accord. It is all genuflecting at the altar of virtue signaling. It puts no binding commitment on India or China. We have too high immigration rates. I think Abbott was right on that, and he's not doing anything about that. So it's not just the cultural conservatives have a lot of problem with Turnbull. I'm a lifelong conservative voter. I doubt Paul is. And last election, I preferenced Labour. I think that the only hope for the right side of politics is to get out Mr. Pyne, to get out Mr. Turnbull. And I actually think we would have been better off on the right side of politics if Turnbull had lost the last election. It would have been close. Shorten would have come in. The defenestrating 54 MPs who knocked out Abbott. And that's another thing that Paul doesn't mention. I can't think of an example anywhere in the English-speaking democratic world where you can recover from ousting a first-term prime minister who brings in a big majority. the Conservatives in the UK were still fighting about Thatcher until pretty much the Brexit vote. Maybe they still are. This is a wound that is not going to go away. I do a lot of talks at Liberal branches and Australian Conservative branches. The anger about that is vitriolic. And to think that you can just cut corporate taxes by a few cents and say, okay, I'm a Conservative, this will not recover as long as Turnbull's in office, in my view.
My guests are James Allen from the University of Queensland and Paul Kelly from the Australian newspaper. We're talking about the crisis of conservatism. Paul, you heard Jim there. I mean, I hear the same message from many conservative liberals across the country. You've even got someone like Mark Latham resonating among a cohort of liberal voters, feeling more and more cast out by their party. You know, intriguingly, you've got Latham and Abbott, not Turnbull, not Bishop, not Pine, not Morrison. They're reflecting the core conservative values. Your response?
Well, I think this point, Tom, is absolutely critical. And we're seeing the development of a marginal ideological position on the right of Australian politics, which has got no prospect whatsoever of being accepted by the mainstream. Now, let's go to climate change and Paris. If the Turnbull government withdrew from the Paris Accords and abandoned our 26 to 28% climate change targets, I think that would be an act of electoral suicide. I can't think of anything better designed to unite the entire range of progressive forces in this country and finance them, and I don't believe for one moment the Australian people would accept that decision. Again, if the Conservatives, as they seem to indicate, want to have a climate change contest, coal versus renewables, then we'll get the same result. They will lose. They will be absolutely defeated. Let's go to the NDIS. The idea that the Turnbull government should walk away from funding the NDIS, again, this is an electoral catastrophe. So my point is, on all these fundamental issues that the Conservatives raise, demanding that Malcolm Turnbull adopt these positions are not positions that I believe mainstream Australians will accept. So what we've actually got here is we've got the development of this far-right conservative ideology, which is self-defeating.
When did it become far-right? A minute ago, it was just, you know, conservative ideology had no hope of winning, and all of a sudden you're calling it far-right. I don't know one single thing you've talked about that's far-right.
The argument, though, is that there are political limits.
It's ridiculous to call it far-right.
What about Paul's argument, though, that there are real political limits imposed on a Liberal government's ability to implement a conservative agenda, especially with this legislature?
Well, I agree that the Senate's very difficult. But again, if you go back to all the appointments Turnbull's made, there's no veto with the Senate on any of those appointments. He could, you know, approach the world the way Donald Trump is and at least put people into these tribunals who have some sort of view of the world that's the same as the people who are voting for him. Again, you can look at the Human Rights Commission. You could put people in who hollow out the institution because of its treatment of the QUT students or its treatment of Bill Leak. But instead, he doesn't. I don't agree that anything that we've been talking about today on the right side of politics constitutes a far-right agenda.
Let me put Paul on the spot here about the issue of coal and renewables, because in 2009, you were in the middle of that great debate between those forces in the coalition that opposed Kevin Rudd's emissions trading scheme and those like Malcolm Turnbull who believed it would be political suicide if the coalition opposed the ETS. Well, ultimately, Abbott came to the leadership on this very issue and he defeated Kevin Rudd and arguably Julia Gillard on the issue of decarbonising the economy. Doesn't that indicate that if you had an effective leader, they could campaign effectively against renewables and climate mitigation, Paul?
Well, that might be the case if you've got a particular outstanding leader, but let's just talk about the practical realities now. And I'd like to go back to the point Jim raised. I think these policies are far-right policies. We've got an international agreement in relation to Paris, and I've got no doubt whatsoever that if the Turnbull government withdrew from that, it would be seen as an extreme and far-right position. I think it would be overwhelmingly rejected by the Australian people. And I think this is where the Conservatives are completely deluded. I think they misjudge the nature of the Australian public. I think they misjudge the nature of the Australian political tradition. And all that would happen if this was to occur would be that the government would be soundly defeated. It would be depicted as a bunch of climate change skeptics, and the force of the Progressive Coalition arrayed against them would simply be enormous. The market research from both sides shows that renewables are overwhelmingly popular. People like them. Conservatives, again, don't get this.
Yeah, Jim, is that a fair point? I mean, the public polling evidence indicates that renewables are popular.
Well, I just want to go back. I mean, I'm prepared to suppose that Paul would classify Donald Trump as far right, but Stephen Harper, of course, didn't go into Paris, and had he been Prime Minister of Canada, he would have pulled out, and it's hard to see him as far right. The Paris Accords are actually, they're not really doing anything for the world's temperature. It's a virtue signaling exercise. China and India are building coal power plants, and very few countries other than Australia are actually living up to it. And the point that Andrew Bolt makes that nobody answers is, what difference does Australia make? I'm a sort of consequentialist. It's like a hundredth of a degree by the year 2100. And for that, we now have the highest energy costs in the democratic world. You know, industries are leaving. You might say that this is unpopular, but I noticed that Mr. Trump has just hit 50% approval in the last Rasmussen tracking poll. He started off incredibly unpopular. But when the economy starts ticking over, things change. And Paul might be right, he might not be right, but there's only one way to find out is to make the argument. You're not going to win an election by saying we're for 42% renewables and Labor's for
50%. Okay, well, let's wrap it up here and just ask, I mean, what does all this mean for the public policy debate in this country? Paul, does this mean that conservatives are likely to keep losing cultural debates to progressives?
Well, conservatives are doing terribly badly. They lose virtually every debate. They've had one great victory, courtesy of Tony Abbott and Scott Morrison, and that was border protection. But I think what we're seeing in this country at the moment, concealed by John Howard's success as Prime Minister, has been the way over the last 30 years progressives have taken control of more and more of the institutions, won more and more of the arguments, and they're now very powerful in this country. I think that if the Turnbull government loses the next election, we will see the conservative side of politics in terms of the coalition party sink possibly into a quite deep crisis in which they'll be outspent, outsmarted and outmaneuvered and have to think through what they stand for again.
Where I differ is I think that it would be a disaster to see the Turnbull government re-elected. Either the party room does something about Mr. Turnbull, or we take our medicine and...
If the Turnbull government is not re-elected, surely the centre of political gravity would move further to the left. How is that in the Conservatives' interest?
I don't agree with that. I mean, if you have a right-of-centre party with a very left leader, you move the whole political spectrum to the left. Just look at Angela Merkel. She's a supposed liberal leader who now has a coalition agreement that reads to the left of the SPD. And so, of course, Bill Shorten would be moved to the right if Tony Abbott came back. He would move to the right the next day.
Paul Kelly is the editor-at-large of the Australian newspaper and author of The End of Certainty. And James Allen is professor of law at the University of Queensland. Most recently, he's also edited a collection of essays called Making Australia Right, Where To From Here.
This is Between the Lines with Tom Switzer.
Well, have you heard of Arthur Schlesinger? He was a leading 20th century American intellectual, Harvard professor, a best-selling author, the in-house chronicler of the Kennedy administration, who hobnobbed with the great and the good in the American century. He was one of those rare things, a public intellectual and full-scale celebrity. He even once donned the cover of Time magazine. Well, according to Sam Tannenhaus, himself a leading American writer, Schlesinger has a lot to teach us. Quote, "No other writer did so much to shape our idea of the US presidency as an office, as an institution, as an incarnation of popular consciousness." Well, to chat more about Arthur Schlesinger, Richard Aldous is the author of Schlesinger, the Imperial Historian. Hey there, Richard. Welcome to Between the Lines.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Now, what is a public intellectual, Richard?
A public intellectual, I think, is somebody who is preeminent in their own field. In Schlesinger's case, he was literally a world-class historian, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, but also somebody who wants to make an impact in the wider world. Schlesinger took that to the most extreme by becoming a member of the Kennedy administration. He was a brilliant historian, but he decided he needed to put his money where his mouth was politically.
And that's why he's such a significant figure in 20th century America, right?
Yeah, I think he's significant really for two reasons. One, because he writes a book, The Age of Jackson, which is one of the most important works of history written in the 20th century. But also for this other reason that he writes speeches for Adlai Stevenson, he goes into the White House, works for Kennedy, and then crucially, he shapes that Kennedy myth in one of his most famous books, A Thousand Days.
Well, let's talk about this Age of Jackson, because that was written in 1945, and I think you mentioned that he was 28.
Yeah, he wins the Pulitzer Prize at 28, which, you know, let's face it, makes most of us feel sick. Yeah, he's a brilliant historian. And what he does is that he takes Jacksonian democracy, this great populist movement in the 19th century that traditionally had been seen as something associated with the West and the frontier, and he relocates it back onto the East Coast, driven by the labor movement, but also people just like him, Northeastern intellectuals.
He died 10 years ago, but I mean, it's always dangerous, you know, asking people what their subject would think 10 years later about current events. But I mean, often we hear about Trump being a Jacksonian president. Do you think Schlesinger would see Donald Trump as a Jacksonian?
I think Schlesinger, I think, would have had two very contradictory thoughts on, you know, he's a classic liberal, so he would have been appalled by the election of Donald Trump. On the other hand, intellectually, I think he would have been fascinated for exactly the reasons that you're talking about, that there is this kind of Jacksonian populism, which is part of not just the election of Donald Trump, but Brexit, for example, in Britain. And so I think he would have been trying to work out what was going on and drawing the historical parallels there.
Take us back to 1965, A Thousand Days.
Yeah, A Thousand Days is his history stroke memoir of his time in the Kennedy administration. And one of the reasons that Kennedy brought him into the White House in the first place was because there was an implicit understanding that when the administration came to an end, that Schlesinger would probably write The Age of Kennedy, a follow-up to his books, The Age of Jackson and The Age of Roosevelt. But of course, the assassination brought all of that to a kind of precipitate close. And so he writes this book in the white heat of the aftermath of that. It's about defining Kennedy's legacy, but also defining people like Bobby's legacy. So he goes from being something of a peripheral character in the White House to being a man right at the center, the man who is going to define Kennedy for generations to come, the man really who perhaps as much as anyone defined that Camelot myth.
This book, A Thousand Days, apparently written in a single year and roughly 3,000 words a day.
You know, in some ways, we understand that right in the hours after the assassination of Kennedy. Dick Goodwin, who worked with Schlesinger in the Kennedy administration, went to Schlesinger's house immediately after the assassination, and he finds Schlesinger already sitting at his typewriter because Schlesinger is always ready to write. So this is something that comes completely naturally to him.
The Imperial Presidency, 1973.
Yeah, this is when really Schlesinger starts to have his doubts about a lot of the assumptions that he's had throughout his life. After all, one of the two presidents who help extend the influence and the power of the presidency are Franklin Roosevelt and then Kennedy. The book comes out around the time of Watergate and the resignation subsequently of Richard Nixon. Mm. So there's this whole debate going on about how the founding father's vision of the president has changed to become this all-powerful character.
This is an intriguing book in 1991, The Disuniting of America.
That's a very controversial book. He never shied away from controversy. This is really looking at the effects of multiculturalism, of identity politics. And although a lot of the analysis in the book perhaps comes across to us as being a bit old-fashioned now, he's asking the right kinds of questions, because after all, identity politics, the relationships between different groups politically and what that will mean, that's something that is very much with certainly American politics, but also the election of Donald Trump and that kind of populism, which is so prevalent today.
Yeah, Richard, I saw a Democratic congressional candidate at a left liberal rally in America last year, and he made the point that all lives matter, and he got booed by the audience. What would Schlesinger say about that?
Well, you know, Schlesinger really, in that book that you just mentioned there, was really trying to get back to the idea of the melting pot of kind of, you know, everyone under kind of one idea of America. And that got a lot of criticism, you know, particularly from the black community, because they said he was trying to go back to a kind of what some described as a kind of a white fascism. But it said something about him. I mean, he was, by that stage, he was well into his 70s, and he's still asking the right kinds of questions.
Richard, I know that John Howard, someone you like and admire, the former Prime Minister, he's a big fan of that book.
Yeah, I don't find that surprising. I remember when I was teaching at University College Dublin many years ago that John Howard came to visit, and I was very impressed by his frankness and his directness. This was right during the height of the Iraq War. None of the questions were screened beforehand. He took questions from students and so on. So there was a kind of, in some ways, it doesn't surprise me that even though they would come from different traditions, that John Howard would like the fact that Schlesinger is prepared to ask these kinds of difficult questions.
Richard, let's turn to a question you pose in your book. Was Schlesinger a great and important historian, a model of how academics and public service can mix? Or was he a populariser and court historian held captive to the establishment that nurtured his career?
And of course, the answer is that he was both. That I mean, he was a great and important historian, even if he had only written The Age of Jackson. He's kind of opened such a deep vein of scholarship there that that alone would make him an important historian.
Yeah, but is there a danger here that a historian gets too close to power?
But that is the other side, and it's something that he wrestles with himself. Sometimes he crosses that line. You know, when he writes his biography of Robert Kennedy in the 1970s, it has a lot of the same kind of narrative flair that you would expect from Schlesinger, but things have moved on. There have been all the revelations about the Kennedys by this stage, and he's not able to deal with that. And so the analysis in the book suffers because of that.
And an historical tidbit, during the Obama era, did you know that the president, Barack Obama, he used to hold several dinners with historians every year, but none of them had an office there?
Yeah, and different historians have reacted to the Schlesinger experience. For example, Bill Clinton wanted Taylor Branch, who subsequently did publish a book about the conversations he'd had with President Clinton. Mm. He wanted Taylor Branch to be his Schlesinger, and Branch said, no, I can't do that. On the other hand, you get people like Edmund Morris, who was given virtually free access around the White House during the Reagan administration and subsequently published a biography. And he found that a very difficult experience.
Indeed. Now, let's wrap it up here with a recent National Review article about your book. The author argues that without Schlesinger's style of intellectual stimulus to controversy, the serious discussion of serious ideas, without that, there is a very real possibility that a civilization will lose its mind. Now, you've got all this social media, the dumbing down of news and current affairs. Do you think that, given that we don't have any Schlesingers these days, that our civilization will lose its mind?
I'm more positive, and maybe this is my experience of seeing America as an outsider, somebody who's moved here. You know, I think for all of the noise around Twitter and so on, there genuinely is a serious interest in ideas in the United States, and that those things are discussed at an incredibly high intellectual level. I would even say, you know, actually, everything that is going on with the Trump administration is a war of ideas. So I think that there is a kind of a sense in which it's sometimes it's easy to say that Twitter means that we're living in an ideas-free world. I just don't think that's true.
Richard, congratulations on a terrific book, and thanks for being on the program today.
Thanks, Tom. It was a real pleasure.
Richard Aldous is a history professor at Bard College in the United States, and his book is called Schlesinger, The Imperial Historian. So that's it for this week's edition of Between the Lines. Thanks for your company. I'm Tom Switzer. Hope you can tune in again next week.